2012-7094, call on Tonio versus DVA. Okay, Mr. Raven?
Yes.
Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yes, Mr. Raven. Sean Raven. Thank you. May it please the Court. Sean Raven, appearing pro bono for Mr. Colantonio. The issue before the Court is whether or not the Veterans Court misinterpreted the statute regarding EJIA, in particular to substantial justification. It's the appellant's contention that Judge Lance had misinterpreted the statute by requiring the appellant to demonstrate and show that the government's position was not substantially justified. The statute merely indicates that there's a pleading requirement, but does not require the appellant to prove that the position of the government was not substantially justified.
Right, the government has to come in and respond once you make an allegation that it's not substantially justified as an element of an EJIA action. Mm-hmm. The government has to come back in and say, oh yes, it was. Here's our reason it was substantially justified. But it's burden shifting back and forth, isn't it?
No, it's not burden shifting. There's no shifting of the burden back to the appellant. The appellant...
You have to respond.
No, there's no requirement to respond either. I respectfully disagree, but if you can see as in Groves and the Veterans Court...
Oh, sure. Okay. So you can just do what was done. You can say nothing and leave the government's argument that what they did was substantially justified and never respond to it, and the court below can say, well, we're not going to do your work for you, which is what they said. And then they say, since you didn't present anything that contravened what the government said, we take their argument as valid, and you lose.
But
now,
that
sounds to me like that's shifting the burden back to you just to come back and say something, or you lose.
There's no requirement. There's no shifting of the burden in the statute.
Well,
the burden.
Right. I don't think he means burden of proof. I think he means burden of production.
Yeah.
Again, if that were true, then any time someone failed to respond to the government's argument, then that would be a concession.
Not if the government made a frivolous or an insubstantial argument. Okay, so I actually understand your argument completely. You don't have an obligation to respond. But if the government has put forth a fully justified and legitimate case on whether or not their position was substantially justified, and you don't respond, are you suggesting that under those circumstances the court would not be able to rule in favor of the government?
Not at all. I think the court and Judge Lance could certainly have ruled in favor of the government and found that the government's position was substantially justified. The dispute that is present is whether or not a judge can deem the failure to respond or the failure to respond in a manner that is, pleasing to the court, as a non-response. And the cases cited...
So if this judge had said the government has established at least a prima facie case that they are substantially justified, and Mr. Colantonio, I'm not saying that right.
Colantonio
has not rebutted it, he hasn't responded at all, you agree. In that circumstance, the court would be free to deem EJIA not warranted.
No,
right?
A little different. Deeming the failure to respond is like a concession. It's a concession that your failure to respond means your failure to respond or respond adequately. It allows...
Sure. Sure. If you look at the government's presentation of its substantial justification,
right,
and you say, these guys are clowns. They haven't made any kind of argument that equals anything that could be deemed to be substantial justification. And you make a judgment as an attorney that I'm just not going to dignify this with a response. You can do that. On the other hand, of course, if a court looks at it and says, hey, in my view, as the court, th- this is substantial justification, you lose. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. And absolutely, if Judge Lance had said, if Judge Lance had written, I've looked at the arguments, I've looked at the Secretary's arguments.
He did say that. He said, you've not provided anything that deals with what is a good government argument. He said that.
Right. Let me respond, if I may. I understand your position, the argument that you're, the question you're raising, but if that's the case, mm-hmm. if you're looking at Judge Lance's decision and you consider your case Patrick, under what circumstances, the totality of the circumstance, did Judge Lance find the government's position was substantially justified? In his two-page decision, what circumstance, what totality of the circumstance? Because Patrick tells us, you wrote Patrick, about 30 days before his decision and after both parties had submitted their pleadings on the EJA. And Patrick says that just because the government's position, the government misinterprets a statute for the first time, doesn't make their position substantially justified. But if you look...
So what's missing in your view is a statement that we've considered the government's arguments and we find that their position was substantially justified.
I wouldn't waste your time if that was the case.
And it's true that there isn't that language in the opinion. But, you know, can't we assume that the court was looking at it and was making a judgment about it?
Yes, you have to assume and you have to find implicitly that he found that the government's position was substantially justified. Otherwise,
can we do that? I mean, it seems to me that a lot of the time with trial courts that there'll be a particular argument that just doesn't get addressed. And we assume that the court did its job and addressed it and resolved it, and the question becomes whether there's evidence in the record to support it. And can we assume that the Veterans Court here did its job?
Yes and no. Yes, you have to assume that Judge Lance, and I can explain and elaborate, you have to assume that if he denied the application for EJA, that he found the position of the government to be substantially justified.
He says, the Secretary extensively sets forth the law establishing his ability to assert that his positions were substantially justified, discusses the decisions in this case, and details the development of the law that supported the court's earlier decisions.
That response, to me, under Patrick, under your case following, about 30 days prior to this decision in Patrick, doesn't allow a reviewing court or even Mr. Colantonio to understand the basis for the judge's denial of the application for EJA. I agree that I would not waste your time if Judge Lance had said, I've looked at the totality of the circumstances for substantial justification, and the government's position has merit. This is and in that particular case, Judge Lance would be pointing out and saying the government had the right to rely upon its misinterpretation. But if you look at his decision, the only two cases he cites, he doesn't cite Patrick, he doesn't cite anything about totality of the circumstances, I think, other than Pierce. He simply says the failure of appellant to respond in an adequate manner allows the court to deem the non-responsive response as a concession. And that's what I'm trying to... that's what I'm asking the court to do, is to look at this in light of Patrick and other cases.
What about the other sentence where it says on page 2 of the same opinion, appellant's counsel's complete failure to address the Secretary's detailed and well-supported analysis in support of its position does not shift to the court the burden of researching and conducting an argument for him. I agree with you. Nowhere does the court expressly say, I find the government's position substantially justified. But when he's referring to it as detailed and well-supported in support of his position, can't we infer from that language? Isn't that enough?
No. I would argue that you have to be able to infer that he found that their position to be substantially justified. But on what basis? On the basis that they wrote a very well-written and cogent and intelligent and nicely flowing argument that was eloquent, persuasive. But under Patrick, what circumstance? There is no circumstance. It's
Did
not.
You submit Patrick to the court, by the way. I gotta be honest with you. I don't even know what case you're talking about as I sit here.
I had a V8 moment.
You what?
I had a V8 moment. You know, when you just go. I had a moment where I thought, oh, I found it this morning. And I realized, you know what? Under Patrick, because I was looking at legal cases. And so, yes, I didn't see it, and it's not mentioned in Judge Lance's decision.
Yeah, but it doesn't deal with this issue. It doesn't say that the Veterans Court gets reversed if it doesn't articulate the reason that it finds the government's case substantially justified.
Actually, I think it might, Your Honor. Would you like the citation to it?
Well, I know the case. Can you read me the part where it says that the court has to do that?
I might on rebuttal if I have that time.
All right.
Thank you.
Mr. Hunter? Good morning, and may it please the court. The court should affirm because the Veterans Court did not misinterpret EJIA in this case. I'd like to direct the court's attention to the first page of the Veterans Court's decision. That's at Joint Appendix 7. Mr. Colantonio argues in his briefs that the Veterans Court required him to prove, rather than merely allege, that the Secretary's position lacks substantial justification. In the first page of the Veterans Court's decision, and I'm going to be skipping here, but this is the phrase, that Mr. Colantonio, this is a finding, that Mr. Colantonio's application satisfies any content requirements because the application contains an allegation that the position of the Secretary was not substantially justified.
Would you agree if we interpreted this opinion as not reaching any conclusion about substantial justification in terms of the position proffered by the government, but rather standing for the proposition that whenever the reply is inadequate to rebut, I will accept as true everything in the government's brief? That would be problematic.
This court and the Supreme Court in Scarborough have said that the Secretary bears the burden of proof. And I think the court alluded to that in Mr. Colantonio's presentation.
So if there's no reply at all filed, the government is not going to win. The court still has to look at what the government has proffered and decided in light of this evidence, and none to the contrary, but in light of this evidence, has the government met its burden of proof?
That's exactly right. It is possible for a determination to be made that the Secretary's position was not substantially justified if there's no reply brief filed at all. That's possible.
You do realize that most of these opinions, the judges actually do state expressly that it was or wasn't substantially justified. That's what's missing here. That's why, unfortunately, we're all here, is that this opinion doesn't have the degree of thoroughness that I've seen in some of these others.
That's right. And if frankly, if I could rewrite it, I would have added that one clause or recommended
well,
that the Veterans Court.
That.
but that's right. But ultimately, I think the court identified the language on page 2 of the Veterans Court's decision where it is the most reasonable reading of what the Veterans Court was doing here was it had the correct understanding of EJIA in mind. There was no misinterpretation of the statute. It properly understood the burdens, and there is no error. Unless there are any further questions, we would stand on our brief, ask the court affirm the decision of the Veterans Court.
I have one other question. Was all the work involved here pre-Waters?
I'm sorry?
Was all the work for which they were claiming pre-Waters?
That's a question I don't know the answer to off the top of my head. The application, I think the application is in the record, so the court would be able to determine based on the line items that Mr. Colantonio sought and the days when he put his hour or 2 hours or whatever the work was, and then match that up. I'm sorry that I don't have the exact answer to the court's question, but I think the court could, looking at that, determine whether it was pre-Waters or not. Thank you.
Was all the work that the claimant compensated for pre-Waters?
Not at all, Your Honor.
No?
No.
How do I know that?
Because along with the requirement of an application being filed, it must be supported by an itemized statement of the time and date of billing. And if you look inside the joint appendix, the EJIA application can be found in the joint appendix at page 27. And following the EJIA application usually are the supporting documents along lines of an itemized statement starting on page 41. But to return to your previous question, I think you requested that I find for you in Patrick any statement indicating that the court must analyze and express its opinion. In Patrick, I believe it's that you wrote, the court wrote, we do not find this reasoning persuasive. We have repeatedly made clear that the substantial justification inquiry requires an analysis of the totality of the circumstances surrounding the government's adoption of a particular position. Here, although the Veterans Court acknowledged this totality of circumstances standard, it improperly focused on only one factor, the fact that the court itself had previously upheld the VA's erroneous interpretation of Section 111 in denying Mr. Patrick's EJ application. And that's found on page 1332, at 668 F3rd 1332.
See, I would read that as saying that because the court articulated what it was doing and articulated the wrong standard, it made a mistake which led to the reversal, rather than that silence was incompatible with its obligation under the statute.
But if you can silently deny an EJ application like a Rule 36, simply say just denied on the application without providing any analysis, there really would be no basis for appeal to this court.
But the problem is you can't appeal to this court anyway, right? I mean, as I understand it, in these veterans cases, isn't the question of whether it was substantially justified ultimately a fact question? And so unless there's some legal error in the standard being applied, it's not reviewable, right?
You're absolutely correct. However, how can I review it if I can't tell you what fact that they relied upon?
So what you're suggesting is that underneath here, unarticulated, there may have been a legal error, and we can't tell whether it was a legal error because they didn't articulate what they were doing.
Exactly.
Right?
If Judge Lance had said, look, I've looked at this position, and although the Federal Circuit has issued a new standard under Patrick, I find that this doesn't meet a raised level of Patrick. Although the government relied upon a misinterpretation of statute, their position is substantially justified. I could have come to this court and said, under Patrick, I think that Judge Lance is wrong. But ultimately, jurisdictionally, substantial justification is a question of fact, which would get me kicked out of here. I wouldn't waste your time. But if I can't tell you what the basis is of the lower court's decision, I have no basis really to appeal. It's basically like giving a Rule 36 to an EJ application, and then I wouldn't have any basis.
Did the government, in its pleading in the Veterans Court, articulate an incorrect standard?
Yes, they cited to Patrick before it was reversed.
Well, where do we find the page of an incorrect standard?
I would have to...
Page 5 of their brief, Joint Appendix 53.
Again, I apologize for bringing this up at this moment. It wasn't my intention to surprise the government.
Nevertheless, it's an extensive brief.
I'm sorry?
I say nevertheless, the government starts out that brief saying the Secretary contests appellant's assertion that the government's position was not substantially justified, and then they spend 10 pages demonstrating that.
Patrick was, right, Patrick was a seminal issue that was totally in favor of finding the government's position to be substantially justified, and when it was reversed on appeal to this court, I believe that the House of Cards falls. But you're asking me the question of substantial justification more than I think what the issue is.
Where on page 5 or any other page of the government's response do they urge that the court apply the wrong standard? I mean, they do cite the reverse decision in Patrick, but they cite it for what seems to me to be a rather plain vanilla proposition.
I read it as saying that, moreover, this court's case law is clear and that simply because an appellant prevails, it does not necessarily follow that the Secretary's position was not substantially justified.
See, for example,
Patrick. And that's, to me, I think that's their entire case.
That's not correct. I thought that was still good law after Patrick.
The proposition...
I mean, that can't be wrong, right? Just because the appellant prevails doesn't mean the government's position is not substantially justified. That's got to be correct, no?
If you, in parentheses, in general, the reliance upon Patrick before it was reversed, I'm just making the point that Patrick was reversed to show that under the totality of the circumstances, the court has to articulate all of its bases, not just rely upon one factor. And it's the government relies upon this one factor in Patrick, which I just think is its argument is a house of cards, and one card was plucked out from underneath. So I would ask this court to reverse and vacate, and to consider Groves and the standard enunciated in Groves about section 2412D about the standard and burden of proof and persuasion.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The case is submitted. We thank both counsel.